A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost, here to make the pound in your pocket go a little bit further. Now it's time for the Money Wise Show. The team with over a quarter of a century of financial journalism under their belts join us in the studio for their weekly catch-up. And today I'm joined by editor Moira O'Neill and product researcher Adam Williams. And to discuss what are the best ways to start investing with little hope on the horizon for savers, we get Money Wise's take on the budget and ask whether NS&I's new product lives up to the hype. And don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the best stories throughout the week. Just go to moneywise.co.uk to sign up to their newsletter and subscribe to the magazine.
Sharing ideas about money. This is Share Radio.
But first, the average Briton saves around £150 a month, we're hearing today. Where are we putting it? Well, despite the poor interest rates on offer, the most common way is still in a savings account. More than half of us say that they did that, followed by a cash ISA, which is used by 27% of us. And this is all according to a survey by Santander. In fact, only 1 in 10 invest and utilise stocks and shares ISAs. Why so low? Well, over at MoneyWise, you've been putting together investing guides for every scenario, from squirreling away 50 quid a month to investing a whopping £50,000 lump sum. So, Moira, a very good morning to you.
Good morning.
What do you put that down to? Why so low, first of all, people investing?
I think people are scared to take any risk with their money. And risk is a funny word. What it means is different for different people. You can have the risk of having the amount of your money wobble over time, go up and down. You can have the risk of your money not keeping pace with inflation. You can have the risk of not missing out on opportunities. The stock market scares a lot of people, but actually, it's not as risky as a lot of people think it is. So if you look at putting your money away for 10-year periods, there's actually, over the past 30 years, there's only been one 10-year period where you would have lost money.
I think that in itself may frighten a few people, that they're going to put away money for that length of time. Are we expecting the savings environment to get any better anytime soon?
We're not, unfortunately. Rates may nudge up a little bit, but I can't see any radical change. And we've also got inflation rising. So if your money isn't really keeping its value in the bank, if your saving rates aren't beating the current rate of inflation, you really need to think about putting some of it, at least, into assets that will keep pace with inflation or are more likely to. And this includes the stock market. Now, you don't have to start buying shares in companies. You can invest in an investment fund, which is managed by a professional person who diversifies your money, or basically adds your money to the money that other people invest in the fund, and then buys a whole range of investments. So you're not putting all your eggs in one basket, even though it's just one fund.
I wonder if a lot of people think it's also... it's quite confusing. It's going to be difficult, isn't it, to set up and invest to invest, isn't it? I don't really want to keep up to date with the stock market, but it doesn't have to be that difficult.
It doesn't at all. One of the easiest things to do is to put aside a small amount of money on a regular monthly basis into an investment fund.
And how
just
small
forget
are we talking?
About it. We're talking where you can put as little as £20 up to £50 a month. You're talking about the average figure there being £150. So you could put some of your money into cash and try a little bit in the stock market as well. And over time, that could build up into quite a significant sum. And the key is to put it into the fund and forget about it, for it to be really money that you can afford to put away for the long term. We're talking at least 5 years, preferably 10 years.
In terms of the smaller monthly deposits as opposed to larger monthly amounts, what are the differences? What should we be considering here?
Well, you need to think about what you're actually saving for and what the goal is at the end. So for most people, they'll be thinking about saving for retirement. Mm. But it could be something specific, like saving up for a wedding, saving up for your kids' university, something like that. Maybe saving up for a new car at some point. in the future. It's always handy to have little pots of money, isn't it? But really, one of the, if I can give you some tips.
Please do.
So one of the funds, well, it's actually a range of funds that's mentioned a lot because it's very, very low cost. And it's a really good way of getting instantly what we call diversified exposure to a range of stock market investments, plus what you call bonds, which are a different type of investment but behave slightly differently. So the name of this range is Vanguard Life Strategy.
Right.
They're tracker funds, really. They're very, very low cost. And you can choose how much stock market exposure you need. So you can have up from 20% in the stock market up to 100% in the stock market, depending on how much risk you feel like taking.
Tracker means it just follows what
it follows what the global stock market is doing.
So in the difference when you said about fund managers, they don't really have those. You don't really need it because they don't really do anything.
It's not got someone buying and selling and making big decisions on your behalf. It's really following the global stock market index, and this that will go up and down over time. But if you're putting regular amounts aside every month, sometimes you'll be buying when it's on a dip and sometimes you'll be buying when it's on a high, and it all evens out over the long run. So take a look at Vanguard Life Strategy.
Okay. What about perhaps if you've got more money to play with or you've got a lump sum?
Yeah, I mean, if you came across a windfall, whether it's from an inheritance or a redundancy package or something like that, and you have a big lump sum that you want to put into the stock market, then you've got to think slightly differently. You need to think about a structure for how you're investing the money. And this is normally called asset allocation. I'm stumbling over those words. I don't know, all this jargon in investing, it is off-putting. But anyway, asset allocation is splitting your money between different types of assets, which include stock market, bonds, which I mentioned earlier, and maybe some commercial property in there, because all of those assets will behave differently at different times in the market cycle.
It's all what you say about eggs in baskets,
isn't it? It is, yeah. It's thinking about just dividing it between a few things so that if one goes a bit pear-shaped, another might be holding up a bit better. So,
what else would you advise?
There are something called absolute return funds. Now, they used to actually, I shall qualify that. They used to be called absolute return funds. Now they're called targeted absolute return funds. And that's because they haven't all returned in the way they were meant to. So they aim to deliver positive returns in all stock market conditions. And so that's their goal. And therefore, they're sort of more cautiously invested, perhaps, than some other types of funds would be. And the one that we like at MoneyWise is called the Newton Real Return Fund, which is actually quite cautiously invested and has a good long-term track record.
What if you do want to get, you know, I think I could do this, and you want to get a little bit more hands-on, you know, you want companies that you're interested in as well to be invested, or perhaps an ethical reason, or you like it.
Yeah, some people do go straight in buying companies directly on the stock exchange. There's nothing wrong with that. It depends on your preference. You might want to go and look at some of the biggest companies traded on the London Stock Exchange. You'll find those in the FTSE 100 index. So I would select the ones that pay out dividends to investors.
So dividends means you just get a little bit of cash.
You get a bit of cash once or twice or sometimes four times a year paid out to you, because those are very, very well established companies and they have a sort of obligation to their shareholders to pay out these dividends. So they tend to be very well run.
And so one of the best for those, for if you're investing for a dividend?
Gosh, you've caught me off guard there, Georgie. I don't know exactly.
But the good thing is, go to MoneyWise.
Yeah, I would go. We have got the information there. But there are big payers. Vodafone's a good one. Big household names. And you need to, I would pick at least five.
Yeah.
Don't put it all in one to begin with. And then try and build that up to maybe 10.
I was going to say, is such things too many?
Well, once a portfolio gets to too many holdings, you'll find it's a bit difficult to keep track of it all. So probably I would put some of your money in one of those tracker funds I mentioned before. So Vanguard Life Strategy for a core portfolio, and then pick a few company shares to hold around it.
Is there an argument for still having things like cash ISAs? I know we discussed it last time round, but or just having it in a cash savings account, or perhaps you'd have it in a current account.
Yeah, still, everybody still needs to have an emergency cash fund that they can draw upon, and the money that you're putting into the stock market won't fulfil that. You don't want to have to draw on money in the stock market in an emergency, because you might be drawing it at a bad time.
Yeah, so there's plenty more about this online on your website, so do go to MoneyWise for much, much more information on that. Thank you, Moira. Now we're going to turn to you, Adam. A very good morning to you. Identity theft. Let's talk a little bit about that. Now, that reached record levels last year. Young people are a growing target. There were almost 173,000 frauds recorded in 2016, according to CFAS. That's 88% of those occurred online. So how good are you at protecting your data? Well, at MoneyWise, you put together a list of 17 top tips for keeping the hackers and scammers away. And I imagine somewhere in that is change your passwords.
Yeah, it is. I think the problem mainly is that people just don't think scammers are that smart. People have the antivirus software on the computer and they think that's all they need to do. But you might be making some really basic mistakes there. Just to give an example, you're in a coffee shop, you're logging onto the Wi-Fi, maybe to check your bank balance or even to log onto Facebook with your password. But that's an open network and it's vulnerable. So in terms of your personal data, that's like leaving your car unlocked with the keys on the seat.
I'm new to that. I always used to sort of check. I didn't even think about it. And now, automatically, before I do anything private, Moira's shaking her head going, oh, Georgie, what are you doing? I take my Wi-Fi off now. But, I mean, we keep hearing about big hacks at companies. Is there really anything that we can do in terms of, I mean, we hear these things like, don't use the Wi-Fi, don't use the passwords. But if companies aren't taking and managing our data, really, is there anything we can do?
Well, I think you can do a lot in terms of your own password. So you want a mix of letters, numbers, uppercase, lowercase, other characters, which is really annoying to remember and annoying to type in, but it is a way that takes a lot longer to hack them. If you want to check online, you can use a password checker and that'll be able to tell you whether you've got a really simple password or a really complex password. And obviously, the more complex, the better. The other bit of advice is just don't use the same password for every site. And I know I'm guilty of this quite a lot, but you need to have maybe a secure one that you use for your couple of bank accounts, one that you use for Facebook, and then one that's just, you know, general shopping or something like that.
Or get a system going. That's what I've discovered recently. I won't give it away, but get a system going that does change it. But of course, for the sake of any hackers listening, you do change your password regularly and it's never the same there, Adam. How can we stay safe from viruses? Is that different?
So you can use the programs that come with your computer. If you're on Windows, there's Windows Defender comes free. There's also some free ones online. Avira and AVG are two of the ones that we like the look of. Some really obvious tips, but the ones we all fall for is just don't click on links in emails if you're not sure about the sender. If it says it's from, say, Amazon, but the link looks a bit dodgy or there's a spelling mistake, maybe just go straight to amazon.co.uk rather than through the link. Always make sure your software is updated because that's going to have the latest protection and the latest virus, the latest antivirus stuff on there. And also watch what you download. So if you're downloading music or movies, make sure they're from a reputable site that you've heard of.
What happens if you have been hacked already? What should you be doing? What rights do you have? Especially if potentially someone's got your details, they've perhaps taken some money out of your bank account?
Yeah, so if that's happened, what you need to do is change all your passwords is the first thing. If it's your bank, they might contact you if they've seen fraudulent activity, but you can also contact them and just say, I think this might have happened, and they can issue you with a new card, which is a great way to reset everything, basically.
And as long as you can prove it was fraudulent or they can find out, then you'll get your money back?
Yeah, that's the thing. But that's why it's important not to do things that are really obvious, and because the bank can always turn around and say, hey, you gave your password away to these scammers. You know, is it really our fault?
That's the first question that they do ask you. Adam Williams, Moira O'Neill.
Sharing ideas about money. This is Share Radio.
A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost, and this is Share Radio on digital, online, and through the Share Radio mobile app. I'm joined by MoneyWise editor Moira O'Neill and product researcher Adam Williams this afternoon. And we've had a week to digest the Chancellor's first and last spring budget, the fallout more dramatic, one might argue, than the actual speech itself. Indeed, The plans to increase self-employed workers' national insurance contributions have, this afternoon, been dropped. The Chancellor only announced it last week, of course, saying he's changed his mind so the Tories can honour a pre-election pledge not to raise them. A manifesto pledge, I believe it was. Oops, I think is probably the term, Moira, for this one. But more generally, you've taken a look at the budget as it was. It may subsequently change, of course, as it has today. But generally, what did you think of the Chancellor's announcement? Firstly, this morning, I mean, this was really controversial, this national insurance contributions. Why so controversial?
Well, people, they were going to level the playing field, basically, between employed people and self-employed people by raising the national insurance contributions that self-employed people pay by 1%. So it wasn't coming up to the 12% that employed people pay, but it was a step along the way. And people were a bit divided on this. There's a lot of talk about it sort of squishing the entrepreneurial spirit of the self-employed. And there was also some talk that it was fair now that everybody's working towards the same getting the same kind of state pension benefits, because in the past, employed people have had an advantage there, whereas now it's just based on the number of years that you work. So I think
in terms of a level playing field, one might argue that they don't get child benefits, you don't get employer contributions. Actually, yeah. the playing field is not level as it is.
No, and it's a very different way of working, being self-employed with a lot
much
of
riskier.
Insecurity, not getting regular pay sometimes. And not knowing, you know, I suppose for a lot of people with Brexit hanging over, a lot of people might be thinking that their businesses are at risk and there's a lot of uncertainty. So to do it at this particular time wasn't great timing.
So scrapping it?
Well, to do a complete U-turn within a week of the budget just seems crazy politics, really, to me. But yes, it is.
One might have realised that manifesto had that statement in from 2015.
Yes.
However, more generally, what else stood out for you that you thought, you know, because actually everything was overshadowed by this, but there was lots in there.
It was, yeah. I mean, many Wise Readers, they had a big budget wish for them, was that we'd have lots of new savings incentives. And really, they're likely to be very disappointed, because what we got instead was Philip Hammond giving a teeny tiny bit of help for savers by confirming this new NSNI bond, which is going to pay a huge, massive 2.2%. Yeah. So nobody is really excited about that.
I'll get Adam to explain a little bit more about
absolutely.
That in a few short moments.
Yeah.
But
One of the other main surprises, if you're a saver, or if you're an investor, was this the cut to the dividend allowance from £5,000 a year to £2,000, and that actually could affect people who have around £50,000 invested in stock market investments. So the argument here is really stocks and shares ISAs have become very, very important. You need to squirrel your money away into one of those tax wrappers to make sure that you're not going to get a tax hit. It was surprising what rabbits weren't pulled out of his budget.
Yeah, what do you think was missed?
We didn't see anything on pensions tax relief, which he could have looked at that. There were rumours of a new social care ISA. Now that didn't come.
More
in
new
either.
ISAs.
No, and there was no help for first time buyers. So there were lots of things that he could have done which he didn't. And also, we were looking at it in terms of gradual, stealthy increases in taxes, because if you don't change allowances, people end up paying more tax along the way. And one of the biggies is inheritance tax. A lot of people in financial planning use the £3,000 gift allowance a year to pass money on down the generations, to give presents to their grandchildren and their children. Mm. And that allowance of £3,000 hasn't increased since 1981.
Wow.
If it had increased with inflation, it would be closer to about £11,000 a year by now. So, yeah, Philip Hammond is not to blame on his own for that. Of course, there's been lots of previous chancellors who haven't increased
since
it either.
That time, absolutely.
But, yeah, interesting to always look at what hasn't happened as well as what has.
Indeed. Well, we're going to talk about what has happened in more detail, Adam, if that's all right. We're going to scooch over to you to talk about this market-leading three-year savings product from NS&I, 2.2%. Sounds tempting, but on closer inspection, does it live up to the billing?
Well, Philip Hammond described it as a welcome break for hard-pressed savers. I think they'll probably want a little bit more than this. So what we've got here is a three-year bond. You can save between £100 and £3,000 in there. It launches April 2017, so start of the new tax year, it'll launch. And anyone over 16 can get one. And then, like you said, it pays 2.2% over those 3 years.
But?
Yeah, but that's the problem, is it is only £3,000 a year. And it was described as market leading. At the minute, you can get exactly the same rate from Atom Bank, and you can put as much as you want in there. But that rate is withdrawn tonight. So if you want to take advantage of Atom Bank's 2.2% rate, you need to do it this afternoon, basically. The other problem with this is you can only get one account each. So there is only 3,000 is the limit. Whereas with something like Atom Bank, you can have as many accounts as you want. Although if you do have a lot of cash, remember you're only protected up to £85,000 with each financial institution in case of a bank failure.
And also with inflation going up, yeah. Sort of eroding your cash return anyway, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the thing. So if you maxed out the £3,000 limit on day one, you'd earn 66 quid after a year, which, you know, doesn't particularly excite me. And then by the end of year three, you'd have £202, making 3202, which, again, isn't particularly exciting. If you want to look at alternatives, Nationwide offer 5% on their current account. That's only for 1 year, though, and it's only up to £2,500. Lots of restrictions here, you'll see. And TSB have got 3% rate, but that's only up to £1,500. And they also require minimum pay-ins or direct debits, register for online banking. There's lots of tie-ins as well. So,
all right, then. I'm not cheered, I don't have to tell you. Right, but it's time for our one-minute challenge. And this week it falls to you, Moira. And as ever, you have 60 seconds to break down a financial topic for our listeners. And with the new £1 coin set to launch very soon, your challenge is to tell us, well, everything that we need to know about it. So your time starts now.
So the new 12-sided pound coin, which is reminiscent of the old threepenny bit, is being introduced on the 28th of March. It's the first time the £1 coin has been changed in over 30 years. It's being replaced because the pound is vulnerable to being faked. The Royal Mint says around 1 in 30 of all current £1 coins in circulation are forgeries. So the new 12-sided £1 coin will be the most secure coin in the world, and it boasts several new security features, a hologram to prevent counterfeits, and it's bimetallic, it has micro lettering, it has milled edges with alternate grooves on alternate sides, and it's got a hidden high security feature built in, apparently. I haven't seen one yet.
You've still got 15 seconds, Moira.
It also has a lovely new design. Shows the English rose, the Welsh leek, the Scottish thistle and the Northern Irish shamrock. And this was created by David Pearce, who won a design competition at the age of 15.
Well done. Very good. And the reason I don't like it is because I've squirreled away all my £1 coins into a money box that you, and I appreciate that you're going to not get a lot of rate of interest on that one, but on a little ceramic box that you have to smash to get them out. I know, and I smash it every year around Christmas time as a little fund for myself, and I'm going to have to smash it by, when is it? October is when they're going to stop taking them at banks and in the shops.
Yeah, it'll stop being legal tender on the 15th of October, but you can still take it to the bank afterwards and get it changed.
All right, then. Fine.
Just won't be able to use them in the shops.
Liberate the cash. Put it somewhere important. Maybe start investing with it. Who knows? Finally, very quickly, Adam, it falls to you for our deal of the week, which this time comes from Sainsbury's Bank.
Yeah, super quick deal here. So if you're looking for a fee-free balance transfer credit card, Sainsbury's Bank have launched a new deal. It's a 28-month interest-free period. You can transfer a balance of £100 or more. And you also get 0% interest on purchases for 3 months as well. So it's a really good credit card deal.
Any catches?
Yeah, so there's a couple of catches. They do charge a 1.5% fee, which they fully refund to make it fee-free, which I think is a bit awkward. You've also got to make minimum payments, 1% of your balance, 2.25% or £5, whatever is greater. So that's a bit tricky to work out. And also you've got to make all them transfers within 90 days of you opening the account.
Fantastic product researcher Alan Williams and editor Moira O'Neill from MoneyWise, thank you so much for joining us. You're listening to Share Radio Morning.